Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin. Now, we had a really good reception last week, Alistair, to the fact that we've just gone back to this old style of podcast, like the Reaction Podcast we used to do years ago before there was a pandemic. And actually, even this time, we're not filming it. We're not on video. We're just talking for all sorts of complex reasons, but including the fact that Wi-Fi is not great during the storm. We're recording this on Friday afternoon and everyone's talking about storms and all that sort of stuff. But Alistair, we're going to kick off. I'm joined by Alistair Ben, my colleague from Reaction. We're going to kick off talking about COVID and the fact that next week is Freedom Day, as it's been dubbed. So it's not the end of the pandemic, or it sort of is the end of the pandemic, isn't it? And we're putting together some pieces in the run-up to that for members of Reaction, which they'll be able to read next week, assessing, you know, what the hell happened. We're trying to term it, aren't we, a second draft of history, as in first draft of history is reporting it at the time. There are obviously going to be many books written about it at some point, which many people won't read because people want to forget about it. So we're trying to capture something about what we think it meant politically and in terms of politics, science, technology, culture, which is quite a build-up to your piece, which you're in the middle of writing.
Yeah, so I'm trying to sort of think myself back into the 2 month period, really, that began really at the end of sort of mid to end of February and then ran through to the end of April, where you really saw the whole system we kind of lived in for over a year and a half, 2 years. It was when its kind of fundamentals, its kind of building blocks came into being. So I was just reflecting, you know, for example, on the 11th of March, 2020, Rishi Sunak, you know, then a sort of newly appointed chancellor, responded to the coronavirus crisis by, you know, a budget whose main components in terms of the kind of, nitty-gritty financial support was really geared towards helping businesses struggle with employee absence.
Yeah.
On the assumption that, you know, you'd see 10 to 15% of the population off sick at any one time. He also widened eligibility of a sick pay to people who happened to be self-isolated but weren't ill. And, you know, within 2 weeks following that, you had the advent of a furlough scheme, which was, you know, ended up including about a quarter of all, you know, just a fifth of all employers, putting, you know, their staff, you know, one employee of their staff on 80% of their wages. This is a completely different.
Yes.
You know, this is a step change in the response. I think it's that's a part of the construction of things like test and trace, the kind of sort of economics of the COVID crisis sort of getting going. And I guess the next few months we're going to begin to dismantle a little bit that kind of thing. You know, we're going to get rid of free testing, which we all subsidize through our taxes, which was instrumental last year in terms of opening up, but probably plays less of a role because of sort of cultural shifts and people testing less if they're ill and self-isolating just when they feel ill rather than all the time. And what I would say is I found it quite difficult to get back into that world. And I think that's what makes it important for us to go back to do, as you say, a second draft, because there are lessons that we have to learn from that period that will be helpful in the future, just as in 2008, there were obviously huge lessons that came out of the kind of, you know, the real peak moments of crisis, which, you know, do you see what I mean? You know,
yeah.
Those kind of 2 week periods, there's lots going on that, you know, lots of mistakes, lots of good things that will help us the next time we're engaged in that kind of speedy onset.
Yeah. What do you think some of the lessons might be? Because we've talked a lot on, you know, in our chats on here, but in Reaction team meetings, which happen every morning, and you've written about it very eloquently, Alistair, the creation of this medicalized techno state, quite authoritarian, dystopian in some regards. I'm not being a, don't propose to get back into all the arguments about lockdown, or maybe we should actually, but it's clearly it's the creation of something close to a war state. And it's interesting you mentioned the budget there actually, because that just reminds me of, I think the week before that, I hosted Week in Westminster for the BBC, and it was a bit of an addition to the programme. How much of the budget will have to be about this new fangled COVID thing? How much will it disrupt Sunak's plans? So that's in, late February. And then, as you said, as you put it very well, just in that, over the course of those few weeks, you get the creation of the world we're now living in. So you mentioned lessons. What do you think some of the lessons are?
So, number one, the response to this crisis did mark a kind of fundamental discontinuity with previous responses to infectious disease in modern history. We have not done simply what people have done about disease for hundreds of years. We have done something different, and we still kind of we're still working out, I think, what that means and what that represents in the for the you know for future responses to disease. And why I say that is because, like many of us in the first lockdown, you go back into literature and history, to read about things like the Spanish flu or Daniel Defoe's Journal of a Plague Year, which is of course a fictional account and a kind of second, again, a second draft actually of what happened. And you go back to Camus' The Plague, and you go back to, the AIDS crisis, and you go through all these things, and you're trying to learn lessons and trying to be clever about it, if you like, and you look for comparisons. So in Journal of a Plague Year, Defoe portrays all the rich people fleeing the city, sort of before they're actually in any material danger. But on the basis that they've got country houses and they've got the ability to leave their businesses where they are and all that. And okay, you say, well, that's a bit like when everyone sort of fled to the country before lockdown, or young people went back to their parents' homes and all that stuff. But Defoe also says in the first sort of stages of that, people despaired because they thought that they might be shut up in their houses, which is sort of the worst, sort of seems to him like the worst thing possible. And the responses are all very local, sort of. It's done through parish councils or through streets and, through sort of micro efforts to kind of stop the spread of disease. So, insight looking back, I think we all made a few mistakes, which is to think, for example, that kind of society, like constructed around a suite of social distancing measures, which are portrayed as kind of working in sync, i.e., mask wearing, hand washing, distancing, testing, and quarantine. This was somehow just a kind of a normal and straightforward sort of human response to what was going on. And if you dissented from that, you were kind of working on behalf of the disease. You were, you're sort of not on the side of the on the right side of the debate, but actually that's not true. And I think we've seen that sort of in reality, the picture has been a much more fragmented one, where lockdowns have played some role in controlling the spread of disease, but actually we've got to now talk more about what people voluntarily did. How people often cut down their contacts without being told to. Why, for example, lockdowns in, for example, the developing world have a quite literally terrible records in terms of the destruction of the informal economy. Lockdowns in South America were a total disaster in terms of the social impact. We're getting, I think, we need to come back to a more kind of sensitive, I think, language about what the costs of what we've actually done in terms of imposing costs on harms on other people, and in terms of the kind of aspiration to say, well, in the future in pandemics, well, of course we'll have a test and trace system, and of course we will enforce isolation, and of course lockdowns will be on the table because these are just the measures that are the kind of new orthodoxy. But actually the crisis, I think, has revealed the limits of lots of those things, while actually illustrating that there are much more powerful, you know, much more powerful things we can do to live with disease. That may be a very long-winded sort of explanation, and
no,
it might be a bit abstract, but it's just, it seems to me like we cannot simply learn the lesson from this that you go harder, you go bigger, you go stronger, you have a better, more biosecure state, you have a more compliant populace with public health. You know,
no, precisely. I mean, I don't. There's a real danger here in history being rewritten. I ran into someone who's been a skeptic all along on all sorts of things like masks and lockdown. And it's easy, I think, to fall into quite a simplistic version of what happened, and to say that what's unfolded since represents total vindication for one position or the other. I'm deeply concerned about the impact of lockdown. We were at the time and we wrote about it. But also it's misleading historically to say, well, it was clearly justified on a basis of unknowns in the very first phase of the crisis. So at the point when the British state realizes that it has screwed up, it won't say that it's prepared for the wrong pandemic, flu pandemic, but it's inside government, senior people like Cummings are forming that view. Oh, good Lord, we're not properly prepared for this. And there's a scramble going on. At that point, you don't even really know. You have to try and think your way back into the mindset. We don't really know about the importance of airborne transmission. It's seen as a factor. But we're still then, because of, and this unfolded through the WHO, and we now know, of course, only later, why the CDC in the US and the WHO, because of a historical error and a glitch, didn't understand the way in which the disease was spreading and working. And that's all to do with an accident, a human error from 40, 50 years ago in one paper, which then sets the guidelines, which become set in stone for the pandemic. And then it takes 6 months or so for a brilliant team of researchers to prove that the numbers in which they base these calculations don't really stack up. So, but if you go back to March and April 2020, people didn't know any of that. I didn't really know about susceptibility, prevalence. You would still hear it said, well, you know, the virus doesn't discriminate on age or all the rest of it. So we were really ignorant as a society. So I can understand that as, so for someone to say, well, lockdown never works, I think it was justified in the first phase. But what I was going to ask you was about trust in authority. Because one of the things that really shook me was early on, wanting to believe that while, of course, you criticise elements of the British state or particular politicians or aspects of civil service culture, that ultimately in a crisis, there'll be a rallying process and people in positions of authority will broadly know what they're doing. And I had that feeling during the financial crisis initially, when I thought, well, the authorities must know what they're doing, and then realised that they were having to improvise, having helped create a policy backdrop which was calamitous, and then having to improvise at speed and sort of make it up as they went along. And a similar thing was happening in the early days of the pandemic. But I do think figures in positions of authority, and this is what I think what is quite dystopian about the way that they've communicated, the way in which they've moved on from one set of very certain sound bites and propaganda arguments, and then just elided, just moved into the next one and not given a proper account of why they've shifted, is, I think, really troubling. Because in that first phase, if you consider what was said about masks or large gatherings or Cheltenham or flights, now I know there is an argument that once it's here, and you know, flights don't really make a difference. I get all that. But the authorities were very confident in the advice that they gave and wanted to give the impression that they knew, and actually they didn't, did they? And changed a lot of their advice throughout, but did so without skipping out the stage where they say, well, some of our initial calculations were wrong, and we're learning more. Am I being unfair?
No, I think it's always a case of a little bit like it's the path of least resistance. You'd have to expend quite a lot of sort of personal capital to be the guy who says, well, when I advocated for herd immunity on March the whatever on the radio, I was in fact fundamentally mistaken about the nature of the crisis and operating on a, on a rule book that wasn't applicable, because that just sounds really bad. You see what I mean? It's like, so in a crisis, I guess you're probably biased to not doing that. I think with lockdown, there's obviously no argument that over a 3 week period or a month of lockdown, you will reduce the number of infections. Potentially over the peak, you will create a peak of virus and it will go down a bit. And I think that is just, lockdown skeptics probably haven't been able to accept that and say lockdowns don't work. Well, obviously they work in terms of reducing social interactions and limiting spread. The point is, obviously, that doing it for 3 month periods strikes me as something a qualitatively different tool. And I actually think the biggest moment of crisis wasn't actually in that 2 week period running up to the first lockdown. It is in the 3 weeks after and during when the lockdown was announced, and the first point at which you could renew the lockdown on whatever it was, April the 17th or 18th. And unfortunately, and tragically in some ways, that Boris was, well, in hospital. Our prime minister was effectively incapacitated, struggled for the next, I don't want to speculate, but clearly he did struggle for the next few months in terms of, some long COVID symptoms or
Still is based on the way that he's
maybe.
governing. I
Exactly.
mean,
He was quite suffering.
I'm not being glib, but it clearly it knocked him back. And the more we learn about this thing, even if you don't have full on long COVID and you're not incapacitated, there are still, well, studies, in the last few weeks showing that the effects are, he'll still, even if it's less than a year since he almost died from COVID, and lots of people are reporting, fatigue, brain fog, all sorts of other flaring up of symptoms or side effects from COVID. So I think it does have a long tail. But I was just
No,
one
exactly.
just wanted to interject on one
Perfect.
point, Alistair, where I know you're absolutely right. I'm not saying that the medical officers should have come out with their hands up and said, "Listen, we got it completely wrong a month ago, but this time we think we got it completely right." But if one of the major features of the crisis, which is apparent now in Canada, in Ottawa, in Austria, in all sorts of other places where where there have been demonstrations, or there's an authoritarian policies are being imposed, and a certain section of the public, whether it's 10 or 20%, really strongly objects, plus the question of disinformation and conspiracy theories. So if that's a big feature of the crisis. Now that's rooted in a fail that in all sorts of things, social media, the way information spreads, conspiracy theories are not new as a concept, but they're amplified by social media and by technology. But it does give conspiracy theorists a way in to the story if those in authority shift their position without acknowledging it. And I think that's a downside of not admitting some complexity and nuance. And
No, of course.
that applies here, and it applies in the US, where the authorities have shifted their position several times. And that is tailor-made for a conspiracy theorist to say, well, look, this is Orwellian. They are they're saying that black is white, and then shifting their position and not acknowledging it. What else are they lying about?
And I do think there is actually the more fundamental criticism of what might be called our sort of medical elites or the people involved with infectious disease modelling or with kind of some of the bureaucrats who have a scientific training is they probably have a too narrowly conceived view of pandemics and what they're doing with them. They probably are likely not to have had a broad training in the humanities. They've worked their whole lives in terms of stopping infections. They are probably not going to realize at times when they're actually saying nakedly, I think, political things, and when they're mixing it with their kind of their commitments in science. And I think you saw that a lot with Neil Ferguson at Imperial College London, who, you know, obviously is a brilliant mathematician, but at times on the radio, in terms of communicating public health stuff, just came across as just, you know, like sort of, you know, like he was overstepping the mark and sort of determining what politicians could and couldn't talk about in the tone that he was expressing it. Whether he liked it or not, he played a huge role in this, and his modelling played a huge role in the change of stance in the UK and in America. It was hugely reported on in America, played a huge factor in the CDC's thinking early on, the Centre for Disease in America. And that modelling, you know, was too pessimistic, even if it was broadly right. His defence is that he was broadly right, but I think because it was too pessimistic, it did actually distort the debate in ways that are still working themselves out, actually.
Yeah. But the model makes sense.
I mean, it's just, I think there is I don't want to come across as all, you know, people who read widely will come up with a better response. Of course, that's rubbish. But the people who are the kind of medical biased people who were in the response were not strategists, were not people who work in crises which sort of operate at various interstices or whatever. They're people who've come up within a particular profession, done very, very well, but they're not the sort of person you need, for example, saying, let's get all the PPE from China right now. You know, and I think that was a sort of problem, actually.
Yeah, I see quite a lot of problems with the fixation on modelling, and quite a few parallels with the financial crisis and financial services and what went wrong there, and maybe even continues to go wrong in certain places. By which I mean, when you get into this, modelers are so sensitive about this and tend to interpret any criticism or questioning as someone like me saying that modelling has no application whatsoever, though actually in a lot of cases I think it provides false comfort, which is what it did in the financial crisis, or rather in the run-up to the financial crisis, in that if you construct models and you essentially put excessive faith in the data and what the patterns are showing you, and then that gives you so much comfort and gives your bosses comfort and chief executives or prime ministers in the case of the pandemic make decisions on that basis, you're just leaving insufficient space for human skepticism, cynicism about human psychology, unpredictability, weird events which can change the model. And I know a modeler listening to this will say, well, that's not what we're doing. We're not making predictions. We're offering a range of scenarios and a central scenario, which is our best reading of it. But it does also remind me, and it's connected to this, we're moving into I hate to use the word dystopian, but it is a data obsessed and driven society. And We've just had in the last week, I was reading the private eye accounts the other night of the post office disaster, you know, the jailing of the postmasters in the UK. If you're listening outside the UK, then you may not have heard of the story, but a public inquiry or an inquiry has opened, and it looks slam dunk like one of the worst miscarriages of justice in modern times in Britain. Essentially, the computer was wrong, and the software from a big computer software company introduced glitches and errors into the totaling. People went to jail. I think four people, as a result, took their own lives, and it's taken 15 years really for it to emerge that the computer was full of glitches and bugs. And hundreds of people suffered as a result. Now, when you read about the management, there's of course there's management arrogance involved, but there really is just faith in the data, and the software must be right, and the numbers, the story that the numbers tell, must be right. And of course, those who install the system have a vested interest in saying that the system that they manage is not glitch prone, and their sales are connected to it and all the rest of it. So that it begins a process by which you're eliminating or reducing the space for human skepticism and for someone to say. I mean, that's when you read the story of the post office thing, it's a disaster movie, and several very, very brave campaigners did pick this up. But you just long for, and as did some MPs as well, who fought for years trying to get answers and trying to get the post office to acknowledge what had happened. And you just long for someone to, disaster movie style, to say, hold on, is it really conceivable that since the introduction of this new system, that hundreds and hundreds of sub postmasters or postmasters of decent, previously blemish-free character and running small businesses suddenly all start perpetrating massive frauds, and then you can't. There isn't any proceed of this fraud, or nothing has manifested itself in terms of assets bought or anything. It's just clearly a computer error. So I suppose what I'm saying is, you chart a disaster like that, which is computer says no or computer says yes, and the computer can't be wrong, and the data and everyone invested in the data can't be wrong. I think there's a read across to the financial crisis, and I think there's a read across to the lack of humility of some of the people assembling the models. And if they're listening, and you're listening, and you're annoyed with that characterization, please get in touch. I know it's more complex than that, but it did, I think. Do you agree, Alistair? It led to some policy errors
Yeah,
in the crisis.
certainly, and I agree actually with the people who tend to defend the modelers on the basis that, well, if politicians can't push back and don't have a way of arguing about this stuff and just interpret it as predictions or interpret it in that way, then that's not really modelers' fault. That it should be politicians coming back and bringing their own criticisms. I think what was really brilliant about what happened in December with Omicron was you did have a kind of pushback against the modelling led by, I think, Rishi Sunak, who is clearly someone who's got a reputation for being not being easily being on top of the data and being on top of the numbers. And actually, that was a really good example of, scientists presenting various scenarios which may or may not have come to pass, and politicians actually doing their job, which is to argue between themselves about what that actually means in the real world. But what had happened before, because of, I think, actually because of a leadership crisis at the top of the government with Boris and with the people around him accepting early on that they would, quote unquote, be guided by the science, and repeatedly deferring to various public health officials of, let's be honest, varied experience in terms of infectious disease. Not all infectious diseases are the same, not all responses are the same. And I think there was a kind of that deferring sort of made it out like all these people had the same response to what was going on. I don't think they did.
Yeah.
And that created a really dire sort of vacuum at the heart of government, and actually was sort of communicated relentlessly by the press. Well, if the scientists are on one side and are communicating to the government must either accept what they say or disagree with it. And that's actually not how decision-making works, and it's not how science works. Science is a, what is science? It is a, it's about pushing the boundaries of what is known. And you're constant, the thing about science is you're constantly coming up against what you don't know and enlarging the boundaries. And actually, science is about being ambushed by uncertainty and being aware of it. It's not about having a fixed view on and a series of social measures which are said to all sort of all go in sync and promoted as a suite of measures, which is what we were repeatedly presented with. And either yeah. Boris was portrayed as accepting the suite of measures or rejecting it. But that is just not how, you know, how the decision making should have been portrayed and how it shouldn't have happened yeah. like that. I think that is, again, I do think, and then there is another criticism which I do buy into. I'm sorry, you know, there's been pushback to, for example, Fraser Nelson and The Spectator posting repeatedly the worst case scenarios and the best case scenarios that government scientists have repeatedly motivated at various crisis points of the sort of experience. And virtually all of them have been too pessimistic. And modelers come back. There was a very interesting discussion with one of the government modelers and Fraser Nelson a few months ago, saying, you know, criticizing, oversimplifying it. But it just strikes me as sort of, you can be a bit too clever by half with this. If every single one of your predictions is way too pessimistic, then there's something wrong with your assumptions about the crisis. And I thought it was very revealing that David Spiegelhalter, who is a Cambridge-based statistician on his Desert Island Disc recently, said that he thought he was sort of, he had too much of an optimism bias to work to contribute in that kind of crisis to government. And I thought that yeah. was actually quite sad, because that, you know, he's a incredibly distinguished person. He's also, his explanations for lay people statistics are brilliant. His book on stats for the general readers is fantastic. And, you know, if someone like that is sort of saying, well, I perceive to have an optimism bias, that's just, that's great.
Yeah. But you made a really good point there about, you made a really good point about the politicians pushing back, which actually they did. And of course, they're human as well, and they're learning the lessons of the crisis as they go and improvising. And the cabinet, it was Rishi Sunak, I think the Scottish Secretary Alistair Jack, a handful of others did really push in at the critical December cabinet meeting, where if the machine had just taken over Christmas, I don't want to get into, you know, cancelling Christmas and all that sort of stuff, but still a time when lots of families reconnected and people saw each other again, and it was relatively normal, though people were careful in the interaction and all sorts of rules were imposed in Scotland. But that's largely to do with the personality, the controlling personality of the First Minister being imposed on Scotland. But still, Christmas happened in a relatively normal way, and that did come down to a handful of politicians and cabinet ministers actively pushing back. Just on the positive side of things, positive aspects of what happened and how the crisis was handled, do you think there are any?
Of course there are, and I think it's been quite radicalizing for people. In particularly young people, I think people are, I think, again, this is anecdotal, but I just feel among people my age, we are much more realistic about the British elites. And it's a bit like our experience. I think you've talked to me before about your experience of Iraq, where you sort of just assume that people know what they're doing in charge. But actually, turns out they sort of don't or are trying to do their best, and it's just tough. And I think especially young people are having a bit of a light bulb moment and saying, well, actually, you know, if, you know, there is a political world out there that we can change, and it is possible actually to begin to think about how we reshape, how we want to make positive change to society, what things we like about society, what we actually want, you know. And I think the crisis for, particularly for people who had the opportunity to kind of reflect, however nasty that reflection was, whether it was, you know, going into the anxiety or depression because of the difficulties of isolation, there was a kind of space in which to say, okay, well, you know, if life's going to be like this, how are we actually going to manage? How are we going to compensate? What people do we really like hanging out with? All that stuff. So there's a resilience aspect, I think, specifically to young people, but a huge amount of struggle. I think the positives, hopefully, I think actually it's not, again, it's sort of a half positive, half negative. I think the harms we're going to see over the next decades in terms of harm to young people and harm to the developing world in particular, are going to make people think twice about the kinds of, again, the kind of biopolitics that 2020 represented, and the failure of lockdowns in terms of the kind of broader social harms they inflicted. And I think, you know, that will be some reckoning in the next decade, and it will not be a pleasant one, but I think it will be ultimately be a hugely positive thing for people to reflect on. Does that make
sense? Yes, it does. It does. Makes perfect sense. There's also been, we should mention that there's been a ton of medical innovation and thinking about the vaccines in themselves, just that positive story. You think back to, well, think how recently it is actually, just that it's really only a year ago, isn't it? Just over a year ago that the vaccination program started rolling out properly. I think I was jabbed on the 30th of January, I think, 2021. And that was a very exciting process. Millions of people desperate to take part in this. And that innovation, it even just seemed fantastical, almost impossible from the perspective of spring 2020, or even, I can still remember the call we were on the reaction team meeting when the news had just broken about the viability of, I think, AstraZeneca, I think, and people working out, and some people were trying, not on our call, but in general, some people were saying, well, it's still years away. And then it dawning, no, this was potentially going to be available in December, January 2021, and just that surge of optimism which we all got from it, and it felt as though the end, some kind of normality was feasible again. So all of that was really positive. I, like you, worry a lot about some longer term impacts, the policy measures which have been taken economically, the splurge, the way in which we're going to live in a potentially a high tax, low growth, aging society, in which people are, you know, I was going to call it the death of the family. It's not that, but just the concerns there are at the moment around fertility and fewer people having children in sufficient numbers and leaving it till later. I wonder if there will be a connection there, just because the long tail of the crisis policy is to have made assets more expensive and those who have existing assets better off. Witness what's happened with house prices. And if you'd said to us 2 years ago, there is going to be a global pandemic, hundreds of millions of people are going to catch it, millions of people are going to die, and in Britain, the entire economy is going to have to be shut down and society is going to have to be shut down and reordered to cope with this. And would have made imagine the predictions were made about things like house prices or the shape of the economy. Of course, there was a huge crash, but then a relatively quick recovery thanks to the vaccines and human ingenuity. But I don't know the answer. I just wonder what the long tail of that is in terms of house prices, asset prices, people postponing setting up home because it's more difficult, and that means then postponing having children. So also just the, we've talked about it a lot, Alistair, just the mental health impact on hundreds of thousands of young people, not just young people, but that is, after all, there is supposed to be a responsibility, sort of the responsibility of age. If there's wisdom, it's supposed to, we're supposed to look out for young people. And I'm still astonished by some of the stuff that was done to young people in the crisis, and even is still being done.
Yeah, I was very surprised by actually the kind of almost putting up the drawbridge in terms of kind of an economy of maybe people were so, everyone has an economy of outrage and emotion, and you have to spend it where it matters. And I guess young people having their lives constricted. For let's be honest, pretty long periods in terms of the kind of the proportion of your young life probably comes quite low on people's lists of stuff. But when it's combined with the degree to which a kind of asset owning class exists in this country and the inability of people to buy houses, the fact that I think, again, I need to be corrected if it's true, but one of the main predictors of whether you have a family is whether you own a house. And it's impossible for vast swathes of young people to do that until they're in their mid-30s, which is an extraordinary shift from even maybe 3 decades ago in terms of when people would be having children. That's remarkable. And you are, I don't think it was just, kind of too far throughout that period to say, hang on a minute, you are in danger of creating a kind of hikikomori Japanese style society where young people become very, very alienated from not just from capitalism, but from each other and become very isolated. And it becomes this kind of gerontocratic settlement where because the pensionable population gets bigger and bigger because of extended life expectancies, young people are sort of experience more and more pressure to pay for them through pension funds and all that. And you get into a kind of pretty inequitable situation. And it's not a genius, doesn't take a genius to point out that throughout history, the best predictor in a funny way of whether societies go belly up or go into periods of real difficulty is when middle class young people feel like their interests are not being listened to. And think about all the great revolutionaries of the 20th century. Well, many of them were middle class people who just felt alienated. And that is not a great, it's not a great cocktail if we're going to go into periods of, as we
That's
say,
an
in the
ominous.
next
That's a.
year, a period
That's
of
a. That's a.
real
That's.
restrictive.
Yeah. That's an ominous thought. But I think there were many good letters in papers like the Times during the crisis. But my favourite letter, really just citing from memory, was Kenneth Baker's letter early on when the question of schools being shut for, for how long were schools going to be shut, and at what point could you should you try and reopen them properly. And Ken Baker's letter captured it just perfectly. He said, someone in his 80s, and that he felt very much that young people should be the young people were the priority, in that he'd said, well, look, he'd had he has and has had his life and has had a fantastic, productive, interesting existence. And it is really the turn then of the younger generation, and that their interests do ultimately or should trump those of older Britain. And I say that, and that's someone in his 80s saying that, not being necessarily uncaring or not saying that people should be cavalier about the disease, but when you're working out what the priorities are, I think he's really got a point. And I think we're really lucky in this country. Maybe it applies across the West with the way in which younger generations have put up, I think sometimes too willingly, but have really put up with a hell of a lot and things being skewed against them in this crisis, to the extent that I really never, whatever disagreements might have on culture wars or all that rubbish, I never want to hear the phrase snowflake again or snowflake generation from older Britons thrown at who own their houses, thrown at younger Britons who don't and who were masked and kept off school and charged £9,000 a year for universities and not, you know, and at some universities actually been putting fences around their accommodation in case they consorted with each other during the pandemic. The way in which the young were treated, I think we're very, very lucky that they didn't rebel, and that they generally took it in a very thoughtful way and understood it in terms of social responsibility. So I think
should
we?
There was the sorry, yeah.
No, go ahead.
Can I just say, yeah, just very quick point before we wrap up. It's that, but yeah, of course, there was a kind of perversity about it in the sense that where the kind of full paraphernalia of COVID rules was actually enforced in this country was in the very few institutions where you can meaningfully do it. So, I mean, Cambridge University had like an incredibly sophisticated testing scheme, for example, which was, yep, I think, a really good example of a kind of locally kind of driven efforts using, you know, labs in the city and all that. But the other side of that was students were constricted in ways that are, for example, I would find unimaginably difficult in my 20s. Like I would never accept that in my own life, the way in which university students were confined and forced to isolate and punished many times for, you know, so many horror stories of people being treated very badly by college authorities and university authorities. And in schools, children, you know, bore the brunt of it in so many ways, in terms of, you know, the masking policies which can be enforced by teachers who, you know, are authority figures. So anyway, there's this perverse thing where the people who really bore the kind of full force of the kind of COVID world are the ones who were at the least sort of at the other end of the asymmetrical risk calculus.
Yes.
And yes, the people who had their lives the least changed by it. Specifically, I'm talking about the kind of middle-aged professional class who were quite happy working from home. There really wasn't that much sympathy, and I would love for there to have been sympathy that I could have identified from that kind of part of society and from from wide swathes of the media, but there wasn't really. And whenever people try to talk about mental health costs, you know, mental health costs are a bad phrase. What we mean when you say mental health costs, this is people who are struggling going into a spiral from which they cannot get out of for years. This is people who are on, you know, who are struggling in difficult housing conditions, losing the capability to do stuff, to earn, to do all that stuff. This is about people falling, you know, really falling through the tracks. Like that's what mental health costs actually means. And I would love there to have been this great debate that we're now having now about the costs and harms in the kind of year and a half period where we were kind of doing them. But I would love to see all the wonderful comment there was about the harms directed at young people and children. But there just wasn't, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I hope we tried to represent the debate at Reaction, but I just don't remember there being much of that. Is that fair?
No, that's more than fair. I mean, the other aspect of it is a class aspect, which I don't like class-based politics much, but it's undeniable that whoever was the first person who described lockdown as a scenario in which middle-class people working from home had parcels delivered to them by working-class people, it was spot on. Now, of course, it was more complex than that, and all sorts of people, you know, retrained or took gigs as delivery staff or essential workers. So I know it's not that simple, but it's a crude caricature, but there's quite a lot in it. And I still find myself surprised. I keep expecting there to be some kind of initiative from the government. Maybe the government is only really interested primarily in older voters, which will end up, I think, probably doing the Tories a lot of damage at some point. But why has there not been some kind of initiative where you put together four or five elements of policy, something on apprenticeships, something on reducing student loan rate or tuition fees, some kind of tax break, some kind of way of saying collectively from older Britons, thank you to younger Britain, and trying to give people a bit of a break. I'm conscious here that I'm in danger of saying, what's that Whitney Houston song? I believe that children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way, all that sort of stuff. So I'm sounding a bit like that, but I really think there is something missing at Westminster, which is some kind of debate or discussion about what was done to younger Britain and how then some acknowledgement of that takes place and policy is adjusted. But I think we should wrap things up there because it's Friday and we've got to you've got to write your piece. I've got to write my newsletter for members of Reaction. If you're not a member of Reaction, visit the site, or the address is just below, and you get my weekly newsletter on politics, as I describe politics, economics, culture. You get pieces from the brilliant Reaction team, Maggie Pagano on business, Tim Marshall on geopolitics, lots of other great writers as well. And you're listening to the Reaction podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction, and with Alistair Benn, my colleague from Reaction. I think we'll come back, Alistair, next week, sort of early-ish next week, when Maggie is back. She's off on holiday this week, and maybe we can discuss some other aspects of it, and also Ukraine, which we haven't covered, and the British political crisis, which is certainly not gone away. But until next time, thank you very much for listening to the Reaction podcast.